Welcome back to the Mediocre Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight is Shane Settner.
Yo.
And Pierce Bauer.
What's up?
Here at the Mediocre Movie Club, we select three movies amongst ourselves as a group to watch each month. We post a review of each of those movies one a week on our website, mediocremovie.club. And then at the end of the month, we get together and discuss said three movies. This last month, we watched Paddington 2, Lady Bird, and Police Story. A threefer, I'd say. Yeah, pretty good
this
trio.
Is, yeah, this is.
We had The Irishman and Marriage Story and Under the Silver Lake last year at around this time. One of those movies was a real turd in the punch bowl compared to the other two, but no turds here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that punch is nice and sparkly and sweet. And
I didn't even finish Under the Silver Lake.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Right. There's some, right. There's stuff to recommend there, but that's a very strange and distant movie. What is not weird and distant, what is in fact warm and intimate, is Paddington 2.
Oh,
Paul
yeah.
King's sequel to Paddington from 2014. Paddington 2 was released in 2018. This is, of course, based on the English storybook. I don't know what Paddington is, and as far as English traditions go, I assume it's just like a Madeline kind of thing, equivalent. Eloise, girl walking around the Plaza Hotel. I don't know what Paddington does.
Yeah, it's a classic children's story, right?
Sure, whatever. Raincoat, rain hat, delightful.
Yeah.
This movie is... We got to go around the horn first. Pierce, Paddington 2?
I think there's two types of cinema. There's cinema before Paddington 2, and there's cinema after Paddington 2.
Sure.
It's the alpha and the omega. It's everything and it's nothing. You can find yourself in it or you could lose yourself in it. You know, it's a movie. No, I'm just joking. But it is like...
Or are you?
A perfect movie. Like, it is just so... I don't know. It distills satisfaction and, like, comfort in a way that, like, no movie I've ever watched maybe has. Like, it is... like cinematic ASMR. It's just soothing. So I loved it and would recommend it highly.
Shane?
Well, there's everything before Paddington 2 and everything after.
Where do you live in the AP2 era?
Yeah. No, it's a great movie. It's a damn near perfect movie. I have zero complaints about this movie.
Yeah, chief advocate for Paddington 2 and master of the year-end montage wrap-up, David Ehrlich, is probably the greatest advocate for Paddington 2. He termed it as the leader in a tiny little mini-trend movie is called Nice Core. It's just sweet and lovable, and it knows exactly what it is, draws all of its characters in, into this very warm, very bright circle. I made a very serious pitch on Sunday to view it as a Christmas movie, and we were all set in a small group to watch it, but we opened the Blu-ray case and the room was just sitting there, so we watched that instead.
But some mistakes were made.
But no, that we did it right. this is a Christmas movie that's not about Christmas. This just represents a level of togetherness and I keep saying warmth, but I don't know what else I would say.
Yeah.
It's great. It's full stop great. It's unbelievably great. I remember watching this for the first time long after it had been out of theaters and living in like the year long hype that had occurred. And I couldn't believe it was as good as it was. Couldn't believe it. The first Paddington is fine. The second Paddington, it starts to go along that. It starts to just replicate the exact same movie that Paddington is, with like the tragedy of heirs, Mr. Bean type, stepping in buckets and shaving old men and et cetera, et cetera. Just things going bad and bad and bad. And then it puts that aside and becomes this incredible heist movie, this incredible like prison escape movie. In really great turns from character actors and like bit parts, and it gives extras like three scene arcs. It's unimpeachable. Unimpeachable movie. Great movie. Great movie. Great movie. if you had to wipe one character out of this movie, and you had to choose between Brendan Gleeson's Knuckles McGinty and Hugh Grant's Phoenix Buchanan, what do you think?
Why don't you ask me to execute one of my own children?
Yeah, that's fine. We'll do that, and then we'll do the harder question with Knuckles versus Phoenix.
I think I,
because I do think the movie comes down to those two performances. I do. I think they steal the movie away from Ben Whishaw, who is incredible as a voice actor.
Yes.
But as far as like a live action performance, it's McGinty versus Phoenix.
I don't know. Pierce, can you choose?
I mean, my favorite character in the movie is Knuckles McGinty.
Yes.
Almost for the name alone. And that whole list of prisoners' names is just like iconic to me. Like that's like some of the best character names ever.
Yes.
There's one, Charlie Rumble is just, I love that. But so I think that character I love more. But I do think, like you said, Hugh Grant, it's kind of a remarkable performance just for like a kind of a dead career that he just like does probably his best work in this very theatrical and kind of slapsticky part in the sequel to a children's movie. You know, like it's just so remarkable that that's kind of what's going to reinvigorate his career, I think, because now he was on the Undoing or whatever. I didn't watch it all, but he's got this whole career in front of him now as like a late stage actor. And it'll probably go back to, you know, like a renaissance from Paddington 2. So
I would think so. He is the villain, but he's incredibly lovable as the villain, even though he's framing this perfect bear, electric toothbrushes in the nose or not. He's a perfect bear. He's the perfect little Peruvian jungle bear. But it's gotta be Knuckles. Knuckles stays.
Okay, Phoenix can go. Okay.
If I had to, you know, in this Faustian, not Faustian, but in this Sophie's Choice, cut the baby into dilemma, it's Knuckles McGinty he's the one that's got to stay. He's just I think the level of detail that Gleeson puts on it. And some of his deliveries, the way he says marmalade, the way his knuckles are tattooed.
Capital N.
I think you're right. You're right.
He's so great. The movie is drowning in these like beautiful, tear-jerking, tiny little moments.
Mm-hmm.
And his like, his warm feeling in his tum-tum, or however the very specific way that he phrases it, that is near the top. it's him. He doesn't really, he plays that kind of character all the time, Brendan Gleeson, but he's rarely like just outright comedic and lovable in this like hard, flinty way.
Mm-hmm.
He's great. He's great.
The movie, like, I was rewatching it for this, and like, I think it is a triumph of the movie. As you alluded to it earlier, like these, like nice core, right?
Mm-hmm.
But like the fact, like what his character stands for in the whole movie is just about like kind of being kind to everybody, you know, which is like such a simple idea, obviously, but not many movies do it as well as Paddington 2. Like this movie is just about like a bear that wants to give a gift to his aunt, you know, and like, I think with a lot of kids' movies, that, like, of course, that theme is there. Like, all kids' movies or whatever have, like, these positive, you know, moral characterizations, right? But, like, Paddington 2 just does it better, I think. You know, like something like a Toy Story or any Pixar movie, like, those also have, like, sincere morals to them, but they also have, like, really gut-wrenching emotions that, like, I think go over the top sometimes, whereas Paddington 2 just does it through simple kindness. Like, that's the whole movie, is just simply, like, giving a gift to somebody or making a friend with somebody. And, like, that, I think, is remarkable. Like, it really is a remarkable piece of filmmaking for that reason, I think.
Yeah, it's a kid's movie. It's all about being kind. This one actually cares to be nice to it. It's like, it likes its characters. Mm-hmm. Every single character. Every single one. So you can't choose to... So it's so hard to get rid of one or the other anyway, but
Yes. Yes.
Actually, like Toy Story, as good as those are, there's always a villain in there that you just don't like, or someone's unlikable, or someone's just mercilessly mocked. Even in those, which, you know, are great movies, but.
Or it takes, like, in, like, I kind of rail against this, but, like, and I was thinking about it a lot watching Paddington 2 this time around, was, like, you know, something like a Toy Story 3 where it has to go to the lengths of, like, having its characters, like, almost be incinerated and, like, look in each other's eyes as they're about to die, you know? And, like, Paddington 2 is just, like, no, he's just going to, like, taste some marmalade and his heart will grow, you know? And it's, like, that, I think, is so much more valuable than having to go those extra lengths of, like, emotional, like, you know, mining deep for emotions rather than just, you know, really, like, taking a look at the simple emotions. And, like, the movie does it well. It does it to, the, like, better than most movies. And most movies don't even attempt something like that. They go too far with it, I think. And
Paddington 2, I think, in the realm, too, of movies for the family, and this just might be an American trend that hasn't made it over to England and English movies like this one, like Shaun the Sheep, like the cartoon saloon movies from Ireland, like Secret of Kells and the new one Wolf Walkers, and there's another movie that I'm forgetting, but Song of the Sea. There isn't like a level of snark or references aimed at parents, like something to keep them entertained. There's truly none of that in this movie. There's a level of like old-timey vaudeville humor that isn't for grandparents who remember seeing a vaudeville show. It's because that kind of stuff just works, as silly and as old as it is. It if it's conveyed with a lot of earnestness and without a shred of sarcasm, which is something that this movie has no patience for at all, then you can still get it across.
Yeah. And I'd say too, like, I'm sure Shane can back me up on this, because I think he probably has to watch more kids movies than any of us. Maybe you, John, I don't know. You're weird. But weird in your film watching habits, not as a person. I like you. But like, you know, when you I haven't watched like the Trolls movies or the Angry Birds or Minions, you know, but like when you think of a kids movie, there's also a visual style that's just like aggressive and obnoxious and like loud and annoying. And to like have just like a calm, serene family movie is, I think, valuable. And like also the visual style of the movie itself should be applauded. Like it's a Wes Anderson movie that doesn't, you know, take itself too seriously the way a Wes Anderson movie does. And so, like, just, like, I think that's another, just, like, a whole other wrinkle to appreciate is, like, not only does it subvert kids' movies and its tone and its humor, but also just, like, it's not a harsh, you know, blast of CGI colors and shit like that, you know? So, like, that, too, I appreciate. And why I think it speaks, again, to, like, wider audiences than just children.
Yeah, I know this movie was like a hit. I don't know if it was one of the most profitable movies of the year or anything, but it is heartening for this kind of, for this brand of like a PG movie that that wants kids in the theater, sure, but doesn't necessarily require them.
Like my kids don't really have the patience for this movie, especially a 3-year-old now out, but the 6-year-old. Even he likes it, but it's like I can't get him to watch this over again. Like, whereas I would watch this all the time with him. I mean, but he's happy to watch the movie. God, what's it called? It's Panda Warrior. It's like a Lionsgate.
That's a movie
knockoff of Kung Fu Panda.
That's very sad.
Like he has to find other warriors who are different species and they have different powers. But this is literally Kung Fu Panda. It's so bad. The animation's bad. It's so bad.
That's deeply depressing.
I'm trying to think, like, who is, like, the D-grade Jack Black that voices it, you know? Like, who would they cast as the...
The guy that was in Balls of Fury?
Yes, yes, exactly.
Dan Fogler?
Yes, that.
Dan Fogler, that's his name, yes.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Panda Warrior.
I do want to single out... Did I get it?
Here's who's in it. Rod Schneider.
Sure.
Haley Duff is in it. So there you go.
Yeah, that all sounds. That all sounds great.
Oh, Jackie Chan's in it. Yeah,
whatever. Imprimatur of respectability there, I suppose.
Yeah, Tom
Kenny. He's never made a bad movie. with Paddington 2, I did watch the, or I did listen to the commentary that Paul King, the director, does by the Blu-ray. The commentary was delightful. But something that he just kept talking about over and over and over again, even though she's barely in the movie, is Aunt Lucy and how much she like looms in Paddington's life. And what really jumped out at me in that first scene that after we watched The Room, Shane fired up Paddington 2, and I had to stay just long enough to catch that first shot of baby Paddington. Impossibly cute for like a CGI creation. It turned me into a Japanese girl for about 10 seconds.
That was weird. I thought I was just really drunk.
Yeah. Hand on the mouth, lots of giggling. But the way that Aunt Lucy, just without hesitation, without like taking a deep breath, without really coming up with much of a plan, just like dives off the bridge to rescue baby Paddington. And then the exact same way that Sally Hawkins at the very end jumps off the bridge with no hesitation and no preparation to get Paddington as he crashes into the river in the train car. That is just totally unremarked upon cinematically as well as just like in the dialogue of the movie. And it's really powerful. And as great as Paddington is, like, just communicates how the people in his life, it didn't just happen. Like, it was made to happen by people who just, without thinking, put their lives at risk for him. And then you get the sense that he would just do the exact same thing. And it's so incredibly sweet and simple. And in between that, to get away from, like, the raw emotionality of it, it is so fucking funny. This movie is so funny. It was probably the best comedy of that year without having a list in front of me. You mentioned the jailhouse stuff with all of their names and the way that they pop into the window. I feel like that's a 100-year-old joke, if not older. Just hilarious. Like where he's pretending to be a bin, but he like completely misunderstands what the directions are. And it's totally normal for a bin to be moving and walking and talking. And he's doing a great job accepting trash with his hands. Brilliant. Absolutely fucking brilliant.
There's a Wes Anderson feel to this.
Hmm? Like yes.
To this, you know?
Yeah.
Or
with the clockwork sets and the houses and like peeling and back like walls and.
Again, like the witty, like the witticism to the dialogue, yeah. It's what you were saying earlier, John. I think where it's like it harps on, it is like simultaneously, it's like Charlie Chaplin, but also like Wes Anderson or whatever. You know, it's like it's doing these like kind of old school comedy through the ages, and like it holds up in a way that you wouldn't expect.
Anything else on Paddington 2? I should also, another plug for the Blu-ray is that you get the full screen music video of the end musical routine in the prison, as opposed to just part of the credits. And you can watch it over and over and over again, as I very much did.
Larger Child did the same thing.
Good for him.
He didn't want to watch Remotion movie, but did want to watch that.
That's not nothing. Anything else on Paddington 2?
I think if for any reason I was ever tasked with showing Alien Life one movie to describe or like to restore their faith in humanity and like trust us, I would choose Paddington 2. That's the highest praise I can give.
Yeah. Then all the aliens would kill all the shapeshifters out there. Hugh Grant, the bad guy.
Sure. Yes. But, very important.
I thought you were just like stating some strange conspiracy theory.
You never know.
We
live in paranoid times.
Anyway, speaking of paranoid, Lady Bird.
Yikes.
It's all time right there.
Our next, oh, nope. First, we need to play our music game. We almost forgot. The random number generator selected number 3881, which is Blinded by the Light. That came out last year. Indian kid finds Bruce Springsteen in Thatcherite London. Or not London. Thatcherite England. I can do this. Let me play nice. Or can I? Can I play nice? Give me a fucking second here. Dean Charles Chapman, who plays Tommen Baratheon, is in that.
What?
Yeah. Ooh. And again, to keep the game going, he was in a World War One movie last year. If you can name that.
Anyway, Sir Pounce.
Pierce.
I wouldn't have gotten it without your hint, but I'm gonna take it. 1917.
Sure. Mark Strong is in that.
Oh yeah, he is. I believe Mark Strong. I haven't seen a ton of his movies. I believe he's the bad guy in Shazam.
That is correct. Jack Dylan Grazer is in that.
Okay, that is that a child?
Did you that is a child. Him? Yes.
Okay, then you win.
He is the he's the hypochondriac kid in It.
Ooh. Oh, wow!
All right, that's not one even for me.
Not even the lead in It.
Another movie with a dense, talent-rich cast of teenagers, or at least young adults playing teenagers, is our next movie, Lady Bird. Greta Gerwig's sole feature debut. She co-directed Frances Ha, and I want to say Mistress of America as well, with current, if not husband, then partner, Noah Baumbach. This is the first thing that is solely hers. It is an autobiographical, semi-autobiographical account of her growing up, her senior year in Sacramento in 2003. And what did we think of Lady Bird? Around the horn, real quick, Shane.
I did not rewatch it, so.
Totally fair.
But go off memory that this is.
Skeptical almost going in, probably.
You know my Greta Gerwig thing.
Why don't you refresh our fans' memories?
Frances Ha is the most overrated movie I think I've ever seen.
Mm.
Not even that it's a bad movie, but it's so wildly overrated. Mm. It's an annoying movie about annoying people. And Greta Gerwig unfortunately represents that. But I was not. I don't know. Everyone said it was so good, so I'm here. I listen. I leave Frances Ha in the past.
Sure. And going into this movie, you were persuaded.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Okay.
I think that Gerwig's probably better with me not watching her on screen act like Greta Gerwig. She plays one character.
Pierce, what'd you think of Lady Bird?
I'm not going to get into the Gerwig discourse on that one, but I will say, I mean, to put it really simply, like, I love this movie. So I rewatched it for this, even though I've seen it probably a handful of times in the last couple of years. But I think it's going to go down as one of the best movies of easily that decade and possibly the century. Like, I just think it's a really phenomenal coming of age story. And I think, to put it brief, like, I think Gerwig understands characters and people in a very sincere way that isn't complicated. And it's really remarkable to see a drama kind of relate on such a like personal level with a bunch of characters that I do not identify with. But, you know, there's a really good quote I read when the movie came out, and I always think about it with Lady Bird, is it's a movie about a bunch of characters you've never seen on screen before, but you feel like you know. And I think that's the perfect way of describing it. Like, every character, every inch of this city feels very real and lived. And even though I have never lived there or met these people, it all makes sense to me on, like, a sincere level. So I love the movie. Can't praise it more.
Where did this land approximately on your best of the decade list from earlier this year?
I think it's top. It was in the top 10, but probably towards the bottom. But I don't know. Upon rewatch, I really was struck watching it again, like, just how much I love it. I think it's so not perfect, because what does that even mean? But it is. I don't know. It's as effective as it should be in, like, a very intimate, and not in a weird way, but just, like, in an intimate level about very simple people and relationships, and it just makes emotional sense, and it makes like as a movie it's just a delightful as a watch.
The familiarity part is a good point.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
Definitely.
Yeah. I was just going to say, but if that's so relatable for me, it just feels like Sacramento is definitely the Indiana of California, right?
I feel like that's something that Greta Gerwig might say.
Okay.
She says there's a line. It's like it's
the Midwest of. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, now I feel like an asshole.
This was also that's in exactly the bottom. The
feeling, though, so it nails it.
All right.
This was also in the bottom of my top 10 of the decade. I want to say 8 or 9, not knowing specifically whatever that means. If it matters, if it doesn't, here nor there. This is I think like a foundational coming of age movie. I think you could stack it up against anything else in that genre, and it would have its strengths compared to the classic coming of age movies, and this was revealed in like Little Women as well, that they carried over Greta Gerwig's follow up. She's just a deeply humanist director. She cares about everybody. She does the Robert Altman, Richard Linklater type of thing, where it's just a choice. The movie is about who it is about. It doesn't have to be about that person. There are many, many, many other people within the movie that could just as easily hold down their own story if her eye was just focused on them. It just happens to be focused on who it's focused on. That I thought that was apparent in Boyhood. I think that's apparent in something like Nashville from Robert Altman, even though that's more of an ensemble. But here I would watch a movie from... the dad's point of view. I would watch a movie from the drama teacher's point of view, both drama teachers' point of view. I would watch a movie from either of the bad boyfriend's point of view, Lady Bird's best friend, the principal nun, and on and on and on. Even the dumb, callow, rich friend. Like there's something there. Just something in her complacency and her comfort level. There's enough of a story there. I believe that she could find it, Greta Gerwig, and just that kind of movie that suggests a wider universe is right in my wheelhouse. That just like tickles all the critical impulses, or knocks them completely out and just makes me fall in love with this movie. It's a great movie. I am not exactly Greta Gerwig's age, but a little older. I graduated in 2002, but I did go to a Catholic high school with like a heavily stratified economic situation. So I'm not going to say like, oh, this movie just spoke to me on such a personal level, because I don't know that. I think that's hacky, but I do recognize a lot of the dynamics within the school. Like Lady Bird is not only concerned with religion and all the classic coming of age type stuff with like figuring out who you are, who your people are, your relationship with your parents, et cetera, but it's really concerned with class. It thinks a lot about class. I think the best part of it is class. That's something that happens as you grow up. You just figure out the kind of stuff that you're just never gonna have. Stuff that's never gonna happen for you. On this rewatch, I really connected with the parents.
Can I jump off that?
Yes, please.
Yeah, no. So I something I was thinking about this time around watching it was, you know, how like I said before, she weaves together a lot of different themes, as you just alluded to, right? Like these things about class or religion or just, you know, being a teenager, right? And specifically a girl even. And all of that, I think, goes under this umbrella of like rebelling against authority, right? Whether it be like religious authority or her parents or whatever it is, right? And I think anybody who is a young person at some point in their life, as we all are or were, can relate to that. And I think the movie does that. That's like what it's at its core that I think we all connect to. Is this idea of feeling rebellious and what that means, right? Like Lady Bird as a character is very self-absorbed, but also exists within, you know, this her surroundings that we all can recognize. Like, it's the good and the bad. That, like, yes, she's self-absorbed, and yes, she's wrong sometimes. But, like, we all felt that way as a teenager, you know? And so I just think it hits those marks very well of, what, like you said, like, even, like, class. Like, when you think of other coming-of-age movies, you know, the, like, the typical kind of John Hughes coming-of-age movie, you know, class is not reckoned with in this way. You know, it's usually something yeah. that is leveled with. It's usually something that is, like, you know, the rich girl ends up with the poor boy or vice versa, and they kind of find their similarities. Where in this, in Lady Bird, it's more about reconciling with the self, just being okay with what you have or appreciating what you went through. And I think that's such a more valuable lesson to take from a coming of age story than, you know, the kind of generic, cheesy, you know, superfluous, whatever else, you know. So on that level, like, that idea of being a young person, and whether you were, like, a young person who went to a Catholic school, or you're a young person who had a mother like that, or whatever it was, you can identify with some rebellious nature of, you know, these structures of the world acting against you. So I think it's a deep text that is well woven. So
yeah, absolutely. And just, like, the title of the movie itself is about, like, rejecting authority. Like, this is the name I gave to myself. It was given to me by me. Like, it's rejecting the first authority. And part of becoming an adult is, like, sometimes authority is authority for a reason. And it's not always malicious and malevolent and suffocating, and familiarity, you know, doesn't have to be stultifying and vacant, and you don't have to, like, long for the other thing, because the thing you have might be fine, and that's not the worst. That's not the worst way to go through the world, is to be that rich girl and be content. It's not that, you know, she's living a good life by any means. She's living a useless and boring life in the long term, most likely. But the idea that her parent, that Lady Bird's parents are somehow less than because they haven't been able to get out of this place. Like, that's just their story. That's just what their story is. There's no actual value judgment on it. And the way that her mom is made to feel bad is something that, again, really resonated. Like, she knows that she's struggling, but with, like, a 20% buffer in a positive direction, she wouldn't hate her life. Her life would be perfectly fine. But when her daughter brings home, like, a boyfriend who very casually and accidentally even just, like, totally slags on her neighborhood, you see how really, really hurt she is by that. And, like, she could live in her station fine. She could be fine. It's just, it's when people tell her that she's doing badly that I think she's most wounded. Because she does not come off well. She's not a great mom. And the terrible, terrible stuff she says to Lady Bird, but...
Right.
I think the movie really gets how critically a child can hurt a parent, whereas most movies are not about that.
Yes.
And it usually goes the other way.
And, like, I would say, like, you know, is a running, like you were saying about, you said it earlier, how every single character has an interesting perspective, right? I think something Greta Gerwig does really well is also every one of those characters are both flawed and redeemable, right? And, like, even the mother, as you said, like, she's not a great mother, but you also see these moments where she, you know, is caring for, she's doing her job, but, like, her being a person that works in a psych ward and is talking with the priest who is, you know, figuring out that he has depression, right? And you see that side of her. Or the brother and his girlfriend, the brother's girlfriend telling Lady Bird about how, like, your mom took me in, and, like, even that side of her is a side you don't see. So it's that she really hammers home this idea with every single character, the kind of multitudes within identity. And I think that's really again, that's what makes the movie pretty brilliant. But it's also, like you're saying, it's affecting. It's when you think about, as you said, when you think about a movie that's talking about how a parent can hurt a child, you only get that through a character that's kind of that dynamic or that multifaceted, mm-hmm. you know? So I think with any of the characters, you can look at the dad, you can look at both boyfriends, right? Like the idea of Timothy Chalamet doing this like douchey, hurtful thing to her in taking her virginity. And then she walks downstairs and sees his dad like strung up on a cancer machine. I don't know what the name is. You know, it's not that
in this scenario, is it giving him cancer?
it's
a cancer machine sounds like something that is distributed.
Yeah, perhaps, did I misread that part of the movie? I don't understand.
Sure. Yeah, that's fine.
No, but it doesn't excuse those actions, but it shows that, you know, it's that idea of we contain multitudes, and she does it with every single character in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good that you bring up Timothy Chalamet's character specifically. One of my favorite scenes in the movie is the drive to prom, and Dave Matthews comes on, Crash Into Me, and they're all slagging. I don't know if it's a good song or not. Who knows? I have a soft spot for Dave Matthews Band. I am a human being. But they, being who they are like, this song is terrible. She's not by any means the most troubled person in the movie. She's going to be fine no matter what. But it takes a great deal of courage to admit that you like something uncool when that's like the most important thing in the world.
I feel like that's when you become an adult.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
And it's also the connection with her friend, the Beanie Feldstein character, right? Because that's the song they listen to in the car together earlier in the movie. So it's not just it's what you're saying. It's the recognition and admission of, I like this thing that's uncool, but it's this larger metaphor for, I also choose my friend who maybe is uncool. And it's, yes. Again, that's also growing up, is just deciding, like, I want to hang around the people who I actually like, you know?
And not to pick on Shame, but like the Greta Gerwig is like a hipster icon, crafting a scene so dedicated to uncool authenticity. I feel like is a total rejection of just any of that idea. There's no hipsterism in this movie. Like, she's not judging. There's not. It's all earnestness and authenticity.
That's why it's a good movie compared to Frances Ha.
All right,
drips with worship and these awful people.
We can't have that conversation again.
We can talk about that, which is Timothy Chalamet being wildly overrated.
Well, yeah, this came up on Sunday during our tiny party, but I disagree completely that he's overrated. I don't think he's like the best character, like supporting character in the movie or anything like that, but. He sure fucking nails the type of person that he's playing.
I
completely forgot from a first viewing that his dad had cancer. Completely forgot. His character makes so much more sense now.
I wish I had rewatched.
There's an offhand comment, and yeah, you see him. There's the glimpse of him in the living room as she's leaving.
That aside, I just like, my problem is buying Chalamet as like a cool guy.
The old T-shirt playing bass, like nothing.
It's just something about his physical presence is like, I'm like, that man couldn't probably hold up a real bass. Why is he a cool guy? Why do people think he's cool? He has nice hair, and then that's it. I don't get it.
Let me jump in here, because I maybe from a younger perspective, and like, I'm not a teenager by any means anymore, but like, girls my age love Timothy Chalamet. Like, he is like the Leonardo DiCaprio of a new generation, as far as like teen kind of heartthrob. But like for a more hipster. You know.
Yeah, that's what blows my mind. It blows my mind that he's fine. Like, I'm totally fine with him. I don't know. He's a fine actor, I suppose. But you just, I don't get it. It's fine. It's not for me.
He doesn't work as much as his contemporary Lucas Hedges, who I feel like they have like an informal who's going to win an Oscar first race between the two of them. I feel like Lucas Hedges makes like 4 or 5 movies a year, whereas Timothy Chalamet is going to get down to like 1 or 2.
There's no way Chalamet's ever going to win an Oscar, is there?
You don't think so? I think he was probably very close in 2017 when Call Me By Your Name.
Oh, that's true. Which I've not seen. Sure. I'd like to see. So maybe I just need to see that and I'll have my mind changed on Chalamet.
He's a good actor. The Lucas Hedges Chalamet comparison is something I think about often, very so often, every day actually. To make the comparison, like it's almost like a Leonardo DiCaprio Matt Damon thing in my head.
Sure. Yeah. Like and Lucas like Hedges, the body types are appropriate there too. Like Lucas Hedges played Shia LaBeouf essentially in Honey Boy, like angry and volatile and a little dangerous. And Timothy Chalamet could never do that.
Yeah.
Like there's just he would never put off an air of I might punch you in the face, random person on the street. Right. It would never happen. Yeah. Whereas I would believe it with Lucas Hedges, as much as I would believe that he was like a closeted Catholic theater kid who's freaked out about what his parents are gonna say. Mm-hmm. So Timothy Chalamet I think does really well in a narrower range. Whereas I feel like Lucas Hedges can maybe do anything. The parents, real quick before we get to cultural touchstones, they just have such a great dynamic. The dad is playing like Free Cell or Solitaire or whatever in the back.
Yes, that scene. Yeah.
God, I love that. I love that so much. There's just nothing. There's like another of Shane's favorites, Gone Girl. There's like a 3-second scene where Ben Affleck is playing video games and the look that Amy shoots him, just like, okay, the movie's over. I know, like, I don't know what's happening in this movie now. Just men playing any kind of video game, even if it's solitaire. I play video games. I play a lot of video games. There's clearly a deep well of shame based on how much I intimately identify with just playing video games while people are around.
Yeah. As a married man with 2 children, it's taken me 6 years to be comfortable with like playing video games again. Before we had kids, and I it was fine, but it's finally to the point that thanks to the pandemic where I told Blair, I was like, hey, I just like playing video games, and she's like, yeah, I don't care. But there's a deep, like, you just feel, it's such an insecurity there because adults aren't supposed to be doing this.
And I wonder if this is just going to go away.
I think it is.
Probably, like, once this next generation is married and has children.
Because now every generation.
And it's not like it's just a male thing anyways. Plenty of women play video games.
Right. Well, now that's a whole thing.
Yeah.
As well, but yeah, like, I got Nintendo when I was 6, I think.
So yeah, it's carpeted basements and a bowl of Cheetos, and the parents have open disdain for it.
Yeah, and once we're all grandparents, I mean, that's it. Our age is all in our 60s, 70s that I think is everyone just plays video games.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot of these thoughts. I had an edible too. So.
Okay.
You guys like to keep going down this path. We got some thoughts.
I don't know if the mom tells Lady Bird that her dad is depressed before or after you see just a throwaway shot of him playing solitaire. Mm-hmm. But that all sounds fine. Yeah, he sure is. Look at him playing solitaire in the middle of the day in a movie.
Exactly. There's something so specific too about like solitaire. Like solitaire is like the most futile thing you could spend your time doing, you know, like all video games kind of are, but especially solitaire. Mm-hmm. And then like around him is like his daughter and his wife having just like an all out like, you know, grudge match. Mm-hmm. And like you said, it's just kind of that this time around, the character who I was most, maybe not connected to, but the most in tuned with as far as like, oh, I didn't pick up on this as much the first time around or the first couple times, was the dad character. I think it's so, again, such a simple, interesting depiction of, you know, something we all relate to in weird and different ways, but again, like never seen on screen, you know? Like I've never seen a moment on screen quite like when the dad straightens up the son's tie.
Yeah.
before the job interview, you know? It's, I was thinking about this, like, this is the way I would describe some of the moments in this movie. So, like, one of those is, like, have you ever seen those things where it's, like, I think it's, like, a German thing where there's these, like, words in German for emotions that just we sure. don't have translations for? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Schadenfreude being, like, the standard because of everybody's in The Simpsons.
That's how I would, like, describe Lady Bird. Like, Lady Bird to me is just a collection of scenes that express emotions that we just, like, have never had cinematic depictions of, you know, in, like, these specific and unique ways. And so, those moments, like, the dad straightening the tie or the mom writing the letters at the end,
mm-hmm.
and, like, the explanation of it, like, that's such a, like you said, you know, the idea of a mother being worried that her daughter thinks she might not be smart through her writing or might be critical of her writing is, like, such a gut punch, but it's also so kind of simple. And I think that, you know, that's the way I would think of this movie ultimately, is it just creates these cinematic depictions of emotions that we just, like, all feel but have no words for.
At my oldest sister, she's younger than me, but at her wedding, my dad got out his, you know, his Southwestern Indiana pieces of paper and gave his Southwestern Indiana speech. And he had written in, "I'm going on too long," or something to that effect. Like, the speech is progressing. He wrote it into the speech. And so did I think in the moment, like, you could have tightened that up a little bit? Yes, of course I did. Of course I did.
But you've also seen a worse wedding speech. So
of course. And with the dad, the movie is almost mean to him in the various indignities that it makes him suffer through. But it has so much respect for him at the same time that he's never, like, a pathetic character or, like, a sad sack. He's just having a rough go of things right now. That's it. Big gold star acting moment is Laurie Metcalf in the car at the airport. And the movie correctly, she comes back too late. But the movie also correctly doesn't show the dad and Lady Bird saying goodbye either. It deprives you of both scenes, even though one actually happened. And
yeah,
you're really focused on Laurie Metcalf because that's... I like I, Tonya. That's a really good movie. But the fact that Laurie Metcalf didn't win an Oscar for this movie compared to the mom, Allison Janney, in I, Tonya is silly.
Yeah,
really I think silly.
It's a perfect encapsulation of what's wrong with the Oscars, is, like, what they think is a good performance, which, like, you know, we don't have to go down the rabbit hole, I guess, but, like, the Allison Janney performance is hokey to me and fine.
It's big.
But, like, Laurie Metcalf's performance is actually, like, transcendent. Like, that scene you're talking about, like, that's what acting is what she does there, and the idea of not recognizing that is just, like, laughable to me. Like, that's the perfect, like, how did you miss that, you know? But
yeah,
the Oscars, I don't know.
Last thing, as far as, like, the cultural stuff, Catholic school, stratified economic status. Some kids are there on scholarship and some are paying full price. Some live in, like, duplexes and some live in giant estates on the west side of Evansville. But the class part of it aside, the anti-abortion speaker really, like, that was pulled directly. I'm sure there are scripts out there or filmed seminars, and Gerwig, I'm sure, sat through some of them. It's just really authentic. It's exactly the kind of thing, if not about abortion, then about drugs, or although they were usually about abortion and abstinence, and just everybody sitting in the gym listening to these sad stories about these twisty affairs about, I was the person who didn't get aborted. Lady Bird did it exactly right there. They should have stood up and applauded her.
Well, it's a good instance of, like, understanding limitations. Like, at first, like, she gives her first kind of crack and it's funny. And then she just like takes it too far. And that's like part of the coming of ageness of the movie is about, or at least that's what I picked up on this time, was this idea of like, you know, understanding why, I don't know, like understanding your rebelliousness, you know, to a degree, like understanding how far to take something. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a good, but you're right. It is also like, it's just a great, you know, it's a depiction of, again, something very real.
Shane, you were a little, you're in college by this point. Well, so was I, but you're like well out of high school, but even still.
Yeah.
Like the authenticity of the time period. Anything to say about that before we wrap it up?
No, I don't remember.
Okay, totally fair. So long ago, 2003. Pierce, anything else? Anything? Last word on Lady Bird?
Last word on Lady Bird. I would say the only other thing I haven't mentioned is just, and we kind of talked about, but like this is her directorial debut, and then Little Women, which I also think is excellent. And I just hope that moving forward, in, you know, when we think back on 2010s and the 2020s in film, I hope it's like Gerwig centric. Like I hope filmmaking revolves around what she's doing in this movie, because and the way we think about films and the way we remember it, because I do think it's important and an excellent movie, you know, like I hope she sticks around and is at the front of cinema rather than an outsider. But, you know, that's a much larger discussion. But
yeah,
Hollywood really seems to hate her.
Two Best Picture nominees right out of the gate. And not only that, but like two very successful movies as well. She's not doing like a critically acclaimed indie that doesn't find an audience. Like she's making successful movies. So it seems like she's stamped her ticket, but who knows if that movies are going to continue to be a thing in the years to come. Another round of the movie game before we talk about Jackie Chan's Police Story. Random number generator spit out number 352, which is Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Who Framed Roger Rabbit? I can speak, trust me. And I have never seen this movie.
What? It's very
high on our list, but I do know that Bob Hoskins is in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. God
damn it.
I don't know anybody else.
No.
I do. Okay. I do. Christopher Lloyd is in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
That's who I was hoping to go with here. I was going to say I can name multiple people in Cool World before I could.
Okay.
Bob, I'm assuming he's the detective guy and he's in Naked Gun.
Oh, Shane.
Nope.
On multiple levels.
I don't know who the fuck we're talking about. I know you do know Lloyd.
Sure. And Bob Hoskins as well.
Okay, Shane, yeah. Go with Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. So confused.
I don't know. I underestimated you, and I apologize.
Christopher Lloyd was definitely in Naked Gun. Kidding. Christopher Lloyd. Let's go with Angels in the Outfield.
Ooh. All right.
Interesting. I'm gonna go with. I believe he plays the relief pitcher. I believe it's Tony Danza.
Ooh, starting
Tony pitcher. Danza. There Tony Danza is in Don John.
Yes.
Don Johnson is in there.
That was before the Don Johnson assault.
Actually, I know.
Sadly.
Actually, I've seen this movie. Now I know. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I'm out.
Okay. Shane's out. Don John to Pierce.
Well, I'm rifling through all of my favorite porn stars that I think make appearances, but I won't name them. Julianne Moore, I believe, plays a role in there.
Yeah, she's in Still Alice.
I've never seen Still Alice, and I probably never will.
It ends with an uplifting speech. One of those movies.
Is it given by, I believe, is it Alec Baldwin?
He might be on stage. I don't remember exactly. Alec Baldwin is in The Hunt for Red October.
Is that... is that Sean Connery?
It is indeed.
Yeah.
He's in First Night.
Is that the Transformers sequel? I thought that was Last Night.
You are thinking of a different movie.
Well, I'm going to guess that Mark Wahlberg is in both of them.
First Night is a mid-90s King Arthur movie. Mm. Sean Connery shows up at the end. No. That's right. He is in that movie.
I think
he shows King Arthur. I was thinking of Robin Hood, where he's Richard III, but he is also in First Knight. He's King Arthur to Richard Gere's Sir Lancelot, and somebody plays Guinevere. Our final movie is Jackie Chan's Police Story. This really snuck up on me. I had no idea that this movie was as good and well-revered as it was going to be. I've seen a handful of Jackie Chan movies in my life. I've seen, well, as far as like his Hong Kong action movies, I've seen Drunken Master, which I really liked, and Super Cop, which I did not like, which is like a some kind of sequel to Police Story. I didn't catch that at the time. But Police Story, all over the place. Crazy. as I quoted in my review, Steven Soderbergh, his initial thoughts after seeing Mad Max Fury Road for the first time is, I don't understand how they aren't still filming it and how hundreds of people aren't dead. I think that also applies to another great action movie, Police Story. Shane, what'd you think of this movie? It's totally fresh for you.
There's no way you could have known this, but I love Jackie Chan. It's the first movie I saw with him. Hadn't seen this one, but this is great. It's the worst of the three movies we're talking about today, but that's fairly damning, you know?
Yes, yeah.
Hardly damning, not fairly.
You can do it.
Thank you. Hardly damning, because it's still a really very, very, very good action movie.
Pierce?
Yeah. I would say it's like the harshest criticism you could give is like it's worse than Paddington 2 and Lady Bird, which is like not really criticism, you know. So no, but you recently, and within the last month or two, John tweeted about a sale happening on Criterion Channel DVD,
yep.
And I copped a couple, and one of them was the double box set of Police Story 1 and 2, because back in high school I got into Jackie Chan movies, watched most of the famous ones, saw this one. And it's just always one of those movies that I thought, like, that's just the type of movie I want to put on sometimes, you know? It's just, you can have it on in the background, or you can make a movie night out of it, and it is totally, like, thrilling and fun and unique, you know? I think it kind of recontextualizes what a movie is and what, like, a performance is. Like, do I care about the story, or do I care about these characters? Like, not really, but it's fun to watch, and it's fun to think about how they made it. And a movie can do that, you know? It doesn't always have to be this encapsulating drama or whatever, you know? And so Jackie Chan's just, he's one of the best movie stars, I think, ever. And he does something, you know, to the best that anyone has ever done it. He is a perfectionist when it comes to stunt work, and it will never be replicated, what he does.
This movie had a bit of a Mad Max feel to me, just because it starts off so batshit.
Yeah.
Crazy. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, but you get everything you know right away, and then you have a ridiculous 20-minute fight scene to start the movie. Fantastic.
Yeah, and he doesn't really do I only watched this movie last week, but I don't believe there's a lot of, like, martial arts in that first part either. Like, that's just a classic. I guess you would call it a Schwarzenegger Stallone 80s kind of thing. I don't know that they necessarily patented that kind of action movie making, but it feels exactly like that kind of movie. Like, there's just a lot of wanton destruction, like destroying all these obviously very poor people's homes. And it just doesn't come up again because it's not important. What's important is that, you know, Jackie Chan stopped a bus with like one shot and a bunch of guys flew out the window, and he probably almost died 3 times in that one scene.
Yeah.
If not more. The level of just complete disregard for his own safety, the movie gives him nowhere to hide. He probably, like, to back up to the Criterion sale, like, this is very, very much on my wish list next time another sale comes around, because I have no doubt that Criterion Blu-ray is loaded with just like making of features.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah, it's like one of the best examples of the almost like the behind the scenes are almost more interesting than the movie.
Yeah,
it does.
I would believe that.
It does have some good making of, and it has him like 10 or 20 years later returning to the filming locations and like redoing the stunts. And you see just how insane it is. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. The present day contemporary for this would be like Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible, where he is like actively trying to kill himself. It's so much more likable. It's a little sad with Tom Cruise, I think, just because he's in a cult that's kind of about superhuman abilities. And it's so much more likable with Jackie Chan.
Yeah.
Like he is being like the abusive cop, especially like the final scene, like that this movie ends with him like mid-scowl, whatever. it's not necessarily the best thing, or not necessarily his sharpest tool in his toolbox, but he's doing all this bad cop stuff. He's not the best guy or anything in the movie, like if you look at it clinically and dispassionately, but he's incredibly likable. And he's likable in such a way that you are really concerned for the safety of Jackie Chan as much as you are for the character, if not more so. I think it first kicked in for me just like almost a paternal instinct, like you need to not jump off of this banister. You need to not run in the house with scissors or whatever. It's almost that kind of impulse where he's like holding on to the bus and like swinging around on a corner, and it's clearly him doing it.
Yeah.
And the bus is clearly moving, and he is clearly not supported by anything other than his hands.
I was like, where's the trick going to be?
There is no trick.
And then they show it to you four times.
Yeah. He did it and like suffered, like as far as that final stunt, not only does he get to the very bottom and the cut doesn't happen for another few seconds, he gets to the bottom and he immediately is on his feet and running after whoever he's running after. But he like really injured himself, like obviously, like second degree burns or that kind of thing. I don't know the exact mythology of police story, but yeah, he was really fucked up during that stunt. But he still had the presence of mind to like land and finish the shot. And he's the director. I didn't even realize he was the director until like an hour in.
That's what I'm saying. He's there'll never be another person like him. It's what you're saying. It's his full vision of the stunt, right? That he coordinates it, he does it himself, but then also like it fits within the movie for not just superfluous reasons. Like it's a good shot in the movie, or it's a good sequence in the movie. It's not just a stunt show. It's also like good cinema or whatever, you know. But yeah. And then I also want to, we should shout, I'm sure we'll talk about this, but like, it's not just the large scale stunts, it's the minor things too. You know, the scene where he has to juggle like 10 different phone landlines, he does that scene like 100 times because he's doing these remarkably, like these very remarkably precise movements and juggling, and he like flips a pencil and catches it. And it's those things as well that I think separates him from someone like a Tom Cruise, even where like those, you know, in today's world, it's just about, you know, what's the big one thing he's going to do, you know? Mm-hmm. And with Jackie Chan, it's every scene of the movie, or not every scene, but any chance he gets, he does something that kind of, I don't know, remarkable, like something that is so distinctly his own, you know, no one else could do it. And so, yeah, it's the big and it's the little, and he does it all excellently.
Yeah, and like two things on that. Like you mentioned precision. There's not a lot of brute force in this movie as opposed to like other kinds of, like I think of like The Raid is, we talked about The Raid last month. Like those movies are brute force movies. Like Police Story is like a really precise action delivery mechanism as far as he's dunking goons in very small spaces or shooting himself through very small spaces, like through windshields from a ways away. Like he's just draining these jumpers, i.e. full body kicks. And that's just as impressive as like being able to throw yourself through. It's more impressive. What am I talking about? Anybody can fall through like sugar glass or like maybe even take a convincing kick, but just to be able to like put your body in that exact right place. It's just a level of like physical grace that goes along with the other thing, to hit off of what you were talking about. Like the thing that makes him unique is that he is doing all this comedy stuff. I don't feel like Donnie Yen or Tony Jaa or whoever. I don't feel like they're even attempting to be comedians. I haven't seen a lot of those movies.
If we're gonna keep comparing him to Tom Cruise, same thing.
Yeah, he's
right.
Tom Cruise has had his moments, but like he doesn't have an impulse to do like an elaborate comedy routine.
Yeah,
and I'm not even saying Jackie Chan is that good at these comedy routines. I don't know.
Well,
I think he doesn't need to take three cakes in the face. I think one would have been fine.
I'd say the you know, the great physical comedians of all of, you know, movie history. It's like Chaplin, Jackie Chan, Paddington the Bear. You know, it's like,
yeah.
And then like no fourth, you know, that's the Mount Rushmore, no fourth even, you know. But no, I do think what you're saying there, John, I don't know the history on this exactly, but you have to imagine that like Jackie Chan, though, again, he invents this language within what you're describing, you know. Like he, it's something really specific he does in all his movies is like, it's not sword fights or, you know, like you're saying, like brutal force. It's, he'll pick up like a shoe. And then kind of do something, like have a goofy fight with that. Like, he's always using his surroundings or objects or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it is Chaplin-esque in that sense of, you know, the kind of the set around him and how he's interacting with it and that slapstick nature that, again, like, you know, I don't know. I know people probably recognize that he's famous and know his name, but maybe don't think of him in those terms as like a, you know, a great physical comedian. But I would say he is.
Yeah, I don't know that he's ever been in like a real bone-breaking martial arts movie, but I would certainly believe it if he wanted to be. It wouldn't be much of a stretch. Like as far as like physically, I have no doubt that he could do that kind of stuff. There's like there are those moments in that those like classic martial arts moments where you are just prompted to exclaim alone in your house while you're watching this movie that holy shit, that just happened. And then like in the one that immediately jumps to mind is like him getting punched in the face and directly into the glass window and the camera is like watching it happen. Mm-hmm. That's an incredible cut. That's just an absolute genius cut, a totally masochistic thing to do. Even if it is shard glass, it still looks like it hurt like hell. Yeah. Like this movie is violent in the way that like Looney Tunes is violent.
Mm-hmm. That's a great comparison.
Which again just makes it more charming.
I let the boys watch some of it with me earlier. They watched the fight scene where they're trying to abduct her outside of her.
Yeah.
So watch that.
And like that's, I thought that was the funniest part of the movie, not so much like the phones or the cakes or whatever. It's the cut from him chasing all the goons away, the smash cut to them driving on the highway very poorly and slowly. That's a solid joke that doesn't require any like rubber face. Slapstick, vaudeville, whatever. So he's got that in him. He just really wants to do the cake in the face type stuff. Having not seen a lot of Jackie Chan shots, I was struck by and I wrote about this in my review probably more than I would have expected. The beefcake shot of him getting into the shower, like he is like a clownish presence, but. I don't know. I feel like in his movies, he always keeps like a t-shirt and jeans on, and like, oh well, no, actually, I am a physical specimen as much, if not more so, than like Bruce Lee, who you know never passed up an opportunity to like flex every sinew in his body.
Yeah,
John, I also thought it was weird that you wrote like a kind of novella length, kind of 50 Shades of Grey.
It was just really surprising. It was really surprising.
Just about Jackie Chan's physique. You know, it was very, I thought that was, it was erotic and it was sensual. And I think the New Yorker is going to do a write-up about it. It was so, you know, it was delicate and it was intimate. I liked it.
Yeah. And then he was washing the second cake off his face. And then he got a third one on. He had to take a shower all over again. Poor Jackie Chan.
I guess if you're a director and you know you look like that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess why not? Film, but
right?
Yeah. Yeah. I he's not like a, Jackie Chan is not a sexual actor. Like, I don't feel like he would ever have a sex scene as opposed to, like, I don't know, like, again, Bruce Lee. I feel like he wanted to be perceived as that kind of guy, perhaps. I don't know.
Did you watch the 30 for 30 in Bruce Lee?
I have, and I was thinking about that. I know that's like I know, like, on David Chang's podcast, he talks about how big a deal it was for Steven Yeun to, like, fuck a white girl on The Walking Dead. But it's not like there aren't these like incredible physical specimen Hong Kong actors, Thai actors, Indonesian actors, whatever, but just, you know, Asian men as like sexual creatures. And we're getting ahead of our skis here. But
you should watch It's Be Like Water, I think is what it's called.
Yes.
Watch it.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Jackie Chan is a clown. And he's also chiseled out of marble. Who'd have thought? anything else on Police Story before we wrap it up? This is a really fun movie. The comedy kind of just like for me, the comedy stretches out the parts between these incredible action scenes.
The one criticism I have, which we're going to talk about, the end is just so rushed and bonkers. I was sitting down, I was like, how's this going to end in 10 minutes? And I found out how.
He's going to kick the shit out of everybody.
Yeah.
And
I found out how it's going to end awesomely. Also, didn't make as much.
Yeah, like he like he's doing a Mortal Kombat X-ray move.
Yeah,
like it's gonna fade into a slowdown, and we're gonna see the inside of the drug lord's body as his ribs are being destroyed, just pummeled into gravel.
11 broken ribs.
it's a really good movie. Available on HBO. I think if Barnes & Noble is still doing a half off Criterion sale, consider buying the Blu-ray physical media forever. Last round of the movie game before we wrap up.
Oh, I was going to say, before we do the movie game, do you want to do, spend the night with, one night in Vegas, a week, vacation, and then get married to one of these?
Okay.
Or Pierce is going to judge our, we're going to both do kung fu noises into it, like kung fu.
Probably not.
And Pierce is going to judge who's better.
Yeah, I don't feel comfortable with that one.
Okay,
no, that'd be tough.
Here, John, just do your
mildly racist
girl. Just do your Japanese schoolgirl noise instead.
Yeah.
oh God! I didn't think you'd really do it.
So, all right, you gotta pick these films. Pick one to. You gotta get married to one. You have to spend a week vacation one on one with the one, and one you have one night in Vegas with.
Police Story, one night in Vegas. I would get tired pretty quickly, I think, of the slapstick. Just like, just place your bet, Jackie.
he just kicks his.
I would want to spend as much time as possible with Paddington, and that leaves a week for Lady Bird.
Okay.
I mean, those were my initial thoughts as well, but I'll switch it up for the sake of switching it up. I would say Lifetime with Police Story, because I just think it's something I'd never get tired of. Give me Lady Bird for a week, and then I'm taking Paddington to Vegas. Let's see what that rascal gets into, you know.
That could be involving the fountains, I would imagine.
Paddington 3, Paddington in Vegas. Who says
no? I couldn't have seen that to begin with, but I still think the correct answer is get married to Paddington.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to do one night in Vegas because I don't know how long I can handle an angsty teenager. I guess by default, the week with Police Story, I could do that. That'd be a fun car ride trip.
Random number generator kicked out 1,045, which is Avengers Infinity War.
Ooh.
So I'll go with Mark Ruffalo.
Pass.
You can do it.
Wouldn't it be funny if you couldn't think of someone? That would be good.
Who's in that movie?
Mark Ruffalo is in. I can't think of the name. There's a famous movie with him in it where he has a famous scene and he yells, and I always thought it was a little bit overrated.
Yes, it is. It's the one bad part of
God
that movie.
Damn it. That's all
the
I can
best
think
part
of
that movie.
The best?
No, I'm joking.
Oh, God, I was going to say. Okay, we're going to put a pause on this game and talk for 10 minutes.
I cannot think of the name of the movie.
They knew, and they let it happen.
What? I can tell you the name of the paper and everything, but I cannot tell you the name of this movie right now. I'm out. Mark Ruffalo to Pierce.
I mean, you, Shane, you can just name a different Mark Ruffalo movie. You know.
I don't know any of those.
All right, John. I'm really going to go for it here. Mark Ruffalo, I'll say he's in a movie called Infinitely Polar Bear.
Oh, fuck.
Why did I just name one of the other fucking Avenger movies?
That would have worked. You just watched one.
God damn it.
I did the same thing a few months ago. It's fine. Infinitely Polar Bear. Pierce is not going to let me have the sweep. I've heard of that. I've heard those words together, and that would be the end of anything I know about it. I got nothing. Tell me what Instantly Polar Bear is about also. I'm curious.
It's about a dad who I think is fighting for custody of his kids, and he's kind of a spectrum bipolar-ish.
It's actually a good movie. It's perfect.
He gives a really good performance. I believe, I'm like 90% sure about this, I believe Zoe Saldana plays the wife. I can check. So, hold on. But I remember that's one of those movies he filmed kind of like in between, like filming on Avengers. And it's a good performance. I recommend it.
You're right. I took 2 points and Pierce got the one.
And
participated.
Yeah. All right.
Damn it. 1 second. I forget what our next trio is.
Spotlight. There yes. it was. Spotlight. That was. I had to look it up.
Okay. That'll do us for this month on the American Movie Club. Next month, we will be discussing 3 2020 movies. We'll be watching The Devil All the Time, Tom Holland in the Backwoods, Hillbilly Noir, I guess you'd call that, Winter's Bone style. I don't know. I have not seen that one. I haven't seen any of these. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which I want to say is Chasman Bode, if not his final role, certainly one of his final roles. That's coming to Netflix here shortly. And Wonder Woman 1984, which depressingly will be released on HBO Now, not Now, Max, on Christmas. So we'll be talking about those three movies. And you can check those out and many more on MunichMovie.club. By the time this episode comes out, I'll have posted a review of First Cow, one of the best movies of the year, which this next round may or may well not join. And probably The Tree of Life. I don't know. We'll see if I can. I'm going to have a lot. That'll be a really long review. I wrote that. I watched that in preparation for my Best of the Decade list. And yeah, there's a lot going on in The Tree of Life. It's got dinosaurs and Brad Pitt. What else? Pierce and I will be doing a brief review of Mank, the new David Fincher movie, and more lengthfully a ranking of all of his movies, of which I think he has 11 or 12. So that'll be fun. That'll be recorded next week. And who knows when that'll be out. Again, I'm slow at editing. And like us on Facebook to follow all these events and more at Munich Movie Club. Follow us on Twitter at Munich Movie Club. On Letterboxd, I am John_Kissel, and Pierce, you are?
PBauer404.
All right. Shane, anything to plug?
No.
Okay.
I'm good.
Thanks for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks, John.
All right. Have a good one.
Have a good night.